When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I have a lot of hats. Acting for me is the hardest hat because I feel like I'm unveiling a portion of myself to the audience. And that is a scary thing to do. That's why people are definitely afraid to go and talking in front of public. You know,
right.
They don't want to reveal that shit.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, June Thomas.
And I am your other host, Isaac Butler.
Isaac, it's so nice to see you again. It's been a while. Tell me, though, whose voice did we hear at the top of the show?
Well, we heard the voice of Arian Moyed, an actor who's probably best known for playing Stewie on Succession, a role which recently garnered him an Emmy nomination.
I like weird sex. I like bad drugs. I'm a very complicated individual.
Excellent. And what drew you to speak with Arian right now?
Well, I've known him for a really long time. I directed Arian in a play in 2005, and his theater company, Waterwell, which you'll hear us talk about in the show. One of the members was a really good friend of mine and the roommate of a playwright I worked with all the time and, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's a small world, off Broadway theater, you know. So what's nice is over the last almost 20 years, I've really gotten to see his career take off from afar. And, you know, this year he was in the final season of Succession. He was also the lead opposite Jessica Chastain in the recent Broadway revival of A Doll's House. And he's also really great in Nicole Holofcener's new movie, You Hurt My Feelings. And so with that trifecta, right, a great performance in TV and on Broadway and on film, I just thought it would be really great to talk to him and, you know, see what he has to say.
Yeah, no kidding. We should also note that this interview was recorded before the SAG-AFTRA, that's the Actors Union, went on strike, right?
Yeah. I want to be very clear about this. This interview was recorded on June 15th, which is prior to the beginning of the strike. I am a proud union member. I would never cross a picket line, and I would never suborn the crossing of a picket line. So this is A-OK. We double-checked it. It's fine.
Awesome. And Isaac, Arian, I believe, mentions a couple of names that some listeners might not be familiar with, Tom and Amy. Who was he referring to?
You mean you don't know Tom and Amy, June?
I know a Tom and Amy.
But. Yeah, exactly. So Amy is Amy Herzog, the Pulitzer-nominated playwright who wrote the new adaptation of A Doll's House. And it's in a very contemporary idiom. You know, when you think of Ibsen, you probably think of a lot of verbiage. This is like, you know, it was 2 hours, no intermission in a contemporary idiom. Tom Ridgely is the co-founder of the company Waterwell. The two of them, Tom and Arian, went to college together. And he was also the director of their plays until he took over Shakespeare Festival St. Louis, where he is still the artistic director today.
Wow. Well, I am extremely excited to hear this interview, but I believe that you have an extra segment exclusively for the ears of Slate Plus members. What will they hear?
Well, I have a feeling we have a lot of Succession heads out there in the working listenership population who may be mourning the end of the show. So Ari and I talk a bit about it, about the tone and atmosphere and how he kind of figured out the style when he was first working on the show. Because, right, he was in the, I think he's in the second episode, so none of it had aired. So no one really knew what it was. And so it's about what that experience is like as a young actor.
Oh, do not miss that. If you're a member of Slate Plus, you'll hear it at the end of the episode. If you aren't, it's super easy to join. As a Slate Plus member, you get to hear extra segments on this show and others, such as The Waves and Culture Gabfest. You'll get bonus episodes of podcasts like Big Mood, Little Mood and Slow Burn. And of course, you will never, ever hit a paywall on the Slate.com site. So to learn more, go to slate.com/workingplus. All right, let's hear Isaac's conversation with Arian Moyed.
Arian, thank you so much for joining us on Working this week to talk about your process.
Hi, Isaac. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you, man?
I'm good. It's crazy to be looking at you right now.
I know. Our listeners should probably know that we actually worked together on a short play at a now defunct theater called Manhattan Theater Source in the West Village almost 20 years ago. Is that right?
That's right.
I was not that long out of Vassar at the time. And you were not that long out of Indiana, right? That's where you studied acting?
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that program and kind of like what its approach was and what it was like to study there?
You know, I auditioned for a bunch of schools and I didn't get into a single one. I didn't even get a call back. Nowhere.
Really?
And yeah. It just, I don't know what it was, but whatever it wasn't working. And I'd read this book, Rebel Without a Crew. Have you ever read that?
I've never read it, but is that the Robert Rodriguez one? Is that
correct?
Yeah. All right.
And at the end of this book, there's like a how to be a great film director section. I don't know if that's what it's called, but in my brain, it's like how to be a great film director. It's like basically his advice to everyone. And somewhere in there, he mentions that to be like a great film director, you have to do a ton of bad movies.
Huh.
And then at the same time, I read Mamet wrote that book of like little like true and false or something
true,
like that.
Yeah, true and false heresies like for that. The actor or something
that's
like that.
That's what
yeah,
it is. Yeah. You would know. And I didn't understand 90% of what he was talking about. I was 17, 18 years old.
Right.
But one thing that he's like, to do acting, you got to just keep doing it. And I hadn't gotten into any schools. And I'm driving down to Indiana University to come and see, like, if I'm going to go here. This is the only school that's accepted me, by the way, FYI. But I'm going to pretend or something. And I met with Charles Railsback and I asked him, how many shows can I do here? And he says, as many as you want. And that was to me, Indiana University's training program. I ended up doing 15 shows in 4 years.
Oh, my God.
Tom Ridgely and I, who I co-founded Waterwell with, we were our freshman year, the leads of Servant of Two Masters.
Mm-hmm.
And then my next show right after that was playing an extra in Keeley and Due. I just wanted to be in a bunch of shows. And then at the program, someone was teaching Meisner, someone was teaching Stanislavski, it was a hodgepodge of stuff. You know, you had a voice, someone was doing Linklater, someone was doing Uta Hagen. Like, it was just like a hodgepodge of things. And I took what I took out of it. The pieces that I liked, I just stole them. I just was like, yeah, I'll take that.
What are the pieces of that you found particularly useful?
I think repetition was such a big idea to me. Again, it kind of goes back into the doing, I think.
Right.
I love being in those rooms that you just kept on going after a scene over and over and over again.
Right. You're talking about the Meisner repetition exercises. Where you're repeating the lines back and forth, and then somehow, though, like a whole scene kind of evolves out of that.
Yeah. Or somehow the emotion evolves to the thing that it needs to be, that uncomfortable, sticky, you know, 20-year-old, like, I don't know what this is feeling.
Yeah, totally.
I love that. I just love that, you know. And then along the way, Tom and I really kind of started studying our own shit, to be real with you. We started reading Meyerhold, you know what I mean? And like stick work, and we did that in a couple of Waterwell shows. Yeah, along the way, like we were finding all the stuff that was like resonant to us, that was really kind of like work for us. We just kept on doing, you know?
Mm. Did you found Waterwell right out of school?
Yeah, it was like right towards the end of IU, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. And this was, I mean, I guess you describe it as a devising company, right? Like, as a company, you collectively created the works. And so you were acting, you were writing, you were directing, you were producing, you were kind of doing all that at once.
Yeah, in the early days, I mean, we had a strong mission of just civic-minded. Like, that was in our mission statement in 2002. And we just really... We were so adamant about using art to change society. I mean, that's, and we were idealistic and we believed it and we fought for it, you know?
Right.
And the word devising wasn't even, at the time it was, I think, called ensemble.
Yeah. It was like at the end of the decade, because it was a term from the UK, it kind of migrated over here. And then it was devising.
True?
Yeah, that's what Waterwell does. That's what the Debate Society does. That's what the team does whatever.
But really at the time it was just called like ensemble. I don't know what we called it, to be honest with you. But it was really mission driven. It was really, you know, the war was happening and we did the Persians because we knew that was a great, you know, and we didn't have to say George W. Bush.
Right.
You know, as close as the Persians about the son of a king who wants to make his dad proud. So he fights a dumbass war and all of his people die.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
We didn't have to say, George W. Bush, what the fuck are you doing? It was just the play, you know?
Right. I think that was the first show of Waterwells I saw.
Uh-huh.
It was funny because there's quite a bit of the show is in untranslated Farsi, like a lot of the jokes.
That's right.
And yeah. There'd be like 20 people in the audience just laughing uproariously at jokes that obviously I did not get because I do not speak Farsi.
Yeah. The Persian community just came out, you know. That was the first show also for Waterwell, outside of just being fun, and it was like a big hit for us. It was the first show that we really started bringing communities through our doors. We didn't know what we were doing, dude, but we're like, Thursday night will be Persian night. And then Persians came. And then we all talked. And they all loved it. And then we're like, fuck it, Thursday and Friday night, Persian night.
I mean, I love that idea of just throwing yourself into it, kind of not knowing what you're doing and just trying a bunch of shit and seeing what works.
That is basically my creative process.
Great. Well, it was nice talking to you.
Thank you so much. Everybody.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
No, but exactly. I mean that. I mean that when I don't know how to do something, or Tom and I didn't know, or whoever didn't know, instead of trying to like figure it out, we just did it.
Right.
You know what I mean? I want to tell you about the nonprofit. Tom and I, everyone was like, you need to get a lawyer. This is 2002. This is a year after 9/11. Everyone's got a lawyer. We don't know a lawyer. We don't know anybody.
Right.
But we found out along the way that the IRS's job is to help us become a nonprofit, not to deny us to become a nonprofit. Do you know that mentality? Just all of a sudden you're like, oh. So we just kind of like turned in our application and it was declined. And it had like 20 pages of why we are declined with like specifics. And Tom and I, like, I bet you we could just like copy paste all this stuff into the application now and send that in. And we did. And we became a nonprofit.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
We're recording this. You've just closed A Doll's House on Broadway, which I saw and very eager to talk to you about. You played Torvald Helmer, who's the kind of, for those of you who don't know Ibsen's A Doll's House, I mean, maybe pause this and go read Ibsen's A Doll's House. And
come back.
You know, Torvald Helmer, who's the condescending and controlling husband of Nora Helmer, who was played by Jessica Chastain. So first off, were you offered the role or did you audition for it?
I was offered the role.
Did you know director Jamie Lloyd's work, or had you met before or talked on the phone or anything?
We hadn't met before. I knew his work. I knew his Cyrano was lauded, but I missed that. And I saw his Betrayal, which I really loved. And so I knew of him. I knew about him. I knew everyone was like excited about working with him. And then we decided to meet up like in London, actually, because he was in London. And I just really wanted to hear what he was thinking. You know, I'm an Iranian male, like playing Torvald that can have a lot of like weird connotations. What are we doing? I'm here. There's no problem. I just wanted to hear. We both wanted to hear from each other just to make sure that like this was really the right fit.
Right. And we should say for listeners who don't know that part of the approach of this play, of Lloyd's approach to this play, is that there were basically... there were zero props and extremely minimal staging.
Yes.
You know, the actors are just, there's just a chair for each actor, a turntable that rotates. Most of the scenes are just the arrangement of the chairs and the actors seated.
Yeah.
And they speak, you all were speaking very softly into body mics, you know, into lavaliers that were, you know, visible and attached near your mouth. I just wanted to make sure, just to paint the picture. And did Lloyd tell you all that from the get-go? Like, this is what it's going to be like?
Yeah.
What was your reaction when you first heard that?
You know, when you walk into a piece like this, bluntly, it could feel pretentious. Right. You're going to walk in, you're like, holy shit, we're going to do some pretentious ass shit where it's just going to be, you know what I mean? And it's not going to feel alive and fresh. Oddly enough, just speaking for Jamie for like in the first 5 minutes, I knew that wasn't going to be the case because his personality is all about heart and love. He's very open. Like, his heart is on his sleeve, and he wants to explore the world.
And he's got those amazing tattoos.
And he's got a shit ton of tattoos. I mean, there's one tattoo over, I believe it's his right eye, that says silence.
Right.
And then we just started talking about Torvald, to be honest with you, because I don't know Doll's House. I don't know the play. I saw a couple scenes from it, you know, in class and shit. But we didn't read it in any of my Indiana University classes, that's for sure. And then when I moved to New York City, bluntly, I wasn't going to be in a doll's house. Unless Waterwell did it, and in that case, like, whatever. So I, like, pretty much put aside Ibsen and Strindberg as, like, not in my life.
You mean you weren't going to be in Doll's House because you're an Iranian immigrant, or because you were
because I'm an Iranian, 20
years younger than any character in a Doll's House at the time?
Or, yeah, totally. And also, but I knew that Torvald was this macho, chauvinistic, sit in the corner kind of guy. And our conversation that day was really kind of lovely because I was like, I'm not that guy.
Right.
Like, I'm just not that dude. And for me, the story is more important than the acting. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And so I was like, I want people to relate to Torvald so they could see in Amy's writings these microaggressions that are in here.
Yeah, because
if it's too big and too bold and too, people are going to be like, that's not me. I'm not going to fuck, you know. Well, why do I have to listen to this? That's not me. But if they see a piece of themselves or see a piece of their best friend or they see a piece of an action that they've done, that actually might move the needle a little bit more. That to me is, and Jamie and I really kind of spoke on those terms. We really didn't talk too much about the acting, Isaac, to be honest with you. Like, I really, you know, I was shocked that I was talking to him, that I was offered this, to be honest with you. I mean,
right.
He saw me in Bengal Tiger, and that really meant a lot to me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think he was really, like, moved by that performance. And you know, and that was a tricky one, too. You know, an Iraqi translator kills an American soldier on stage. Like, and trying to find sympathy for that isn't, you know,
right.
Needs some navigation.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So that's interesting that you sort of figured out pretty early on what your kind of mission for the character was. I'm interested in how you went about that. Like, are you someone who does a lot of script analysis or a lot of research, or is it more about being impulsive and capturing the feeling? Like, what's the beginning point for you as you're sitting down with a script and thinking about bringing a character to life?
I was told this by Terrell McCraney,
mm-hmm.
in this class that we teach at Waterwell called The Artist's Citizen. And Terrell McCraney learned this from August Wilson, that all great art runs on three cylinders. The interpersonal, the global, and the spiritual.
Mm.
And the thing that most people are afraid of is the spiritual. And so when I read A Doll's House, especially Amy's version of A Doll's House, and then I read that version, and then I was reading Frank McGinnis's, and I was reading, and you know, also weirdly, the only woman's version of this I read is Amy Herzog's.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's not, that's also so fucked up. But so you're reading all these other versions of it, and I can see the trappings of it. I can see, I'm like, yeah, it's a little bit of script analysis. It's a little bit of just, you know, I think more about the story than I think about the character. Mm. And I really love to tap into the spiritual element. When I was doing Bengal Tiger, I was just talking to Rajiv Joseph, who wrote this Pulitzer Prize finalist play called The Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, which started at the Kirk Douglas, and then went to the Mark Taper, and then went to Broadway, starring Robin Williams. And Rajiv was just telling me there's a moment in Bengal Tiger where the character of Musa, the one I play, is fighting for his life with this soldier, and then he exclaims, "I am an artist." And Rajiv said to me, "You know, when I wrote that, and in the, I'll tell you how I performed it. I said it twice with an exclamation point, loud, emphatic, and like with pain. I was trying to go for." And then Rajiv just told me that when he wrote it, it said, "I am an artist" once, and there was a period.
Hmm.
And I was like, that's impossible. I don't remember that at all. He goes, yeah, I can send you a clip of it. I can send you a photo shot of it. I was like, that's crazy. Because in my mind, I must have read that, and it, like, the whole thing made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
The
whole
totally.
Thing makes complete sense to me of who this person is. And then I could see him sweat more. I could see him smoke 40 cigarettes a day. I can see him, you know, waking up in the middle of the night from a trauma. I can see all that stuff started diving in and becoming very real to me, Isaac. Mm. And
it's almost like an image forms in your mind of what the character would be like in real life, not on the stage. Yeah. And then you're trying to, like, not imitate that image, but find a way to be that image.
Yes, correct.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. And as I'm going towards that image, as I'm going towards that, it's more and more things start falling into line. I'll tell you about how there's two lines in A Doll's House. There's one monologue. The monologue is, he has, that Amy kind of wrote in. It's called, I call it the Torvi monologue, in which he is talking to his wife, Nora, played by the amazing by Jessica Chastain, that Krogstad, this guy that he hates, and he hates him because every time he walks into a room, he calls him Torvi, a name that he despises. And it's so mortifying for him that he could never work with this man again. Right? And obviously, and the next line, Jessica Chastain, Nora says, I mean, Torvald, you're kidding, right? No, why? That seems so petty.
Right.
Because it is petty. And you read that and you know these guys. You know these guys. They don't have the guts to be like, hey, Isaac, dude, I don't want you to call me Torvi.
Right, right.
Like, I don't know how to tell you this. It just bothers me. So if you want to be cool, and then, you know, Isaac would be like, okay, cool.
Right, right.
I won't call you Torvi. I didn't even really know. But this guy is those guys that can't muster that up. So we're both laughing right now.
Right.
Because we know this guy and we feel, oh, God, just, dude. But now I want to be that guy. So
right,
I'm
right.
Imagining
you have to suspend that judgment.
Oh,
and have
forget
a,
all that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Doesn't matter to me what people think of this.
Right.
This is so death-defyingly painful, you know. And then you perform it and then you do it and then I'm in the rehearsal process and there's no one laughing. It's all very real in there.
Mm-hmm.
And our first show, Isaac, they laugh.
Right. Because it's a different thing once there's an audience in there.
They start laughing at Torvi. Yeah. And again, because we just laughed too.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? But now I just did 5.5 weeks of making sure that this feeling is fucking real.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Which is an ugly feeling. I mean, you're holding on to, I mean, Torvald is ultimately, you know, obviously, like, you inhabit him in a way in which he's sympathetic, because that's part of what you're trying to do is have the kind of slow revelation of how ugly he is.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of ugly shit to have to hold on to. Is it a relief to let that go? Or are you struggling to let that go now? Is it gone?
That's a relief
for
me. It's gone.
I bet. Yeah.
I put that stuff aside. It's over for me. You know, I did it. I exercised that. I also learned from that. I will never do that. I will never fucking behave in that way.
Right. Right.
You know, a lot of actors came up to me and said, you know, I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could just, like, take the brunt end of being, like, hated every night.
Right.
You know, someone, because a certain deep people watch the show and they fucking hate Torvald. I get it. Totally get it. And to me, I think about how amazing it is that, like, I can make people fucking hate me so deeply. I don't know. It's just so cool.
That is cool. That is cool. Yeah. But, you know, that's something actors struggle with. When we were reporting out The World Only Spins Forward, the book I did on Angels in America, it's like every actor we talked to who played Joe, it got to them that the audience despised him so much.
Mm-hmm,
you know, it was hard for them to do that night after night. It is a weird thing to feel, even if no one says it to you, like, you feel the energy in the room.
Yo, they hate him.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah. I mean, I totally feel the energy, and the energy really is strong, especially when we were doing autographs. People were like, I fucking hated you, dude.
What a weird thing to say to someone at the stage door.
I know.
We'll be back with more of Isaac's conversation with Aryan Moyed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app.
Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp's software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. Ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Currents issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Every other Thursday on Working Overtime, we answer listener questions. And so we would love to receive yours. Please tell us your creative challenges. Let us help you. Drop us a line at working@slate.com, or you can even send a voice memo to that address. That would be lovely. Or give us a ring at 304-933-WORK and leave a message. And if you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts. Now let's return to Isaac's conversation with Aryan Moyad.
I'm very interested in how you made the leap that you made from someone who's kind of, you know, working on stage with your own company, you know, scrambling, et cetera, and so forth,
yeah, scrambling.
To, you know, being on Broadway, being on TV and film, making a living as an actor. I mean, that jump is one that lots of people attempt and don't make, right? We all know that. But you attempted it and you made it. And so I'm just interested in like how you went about that. How did you get an agent? How did you start going out for roles? Was it because Waterwell was getting press and people came to see it?
Yeah.
Or, you know, what was that journey? Can you tell me that story?
The Persians that we were mentioning earlier got a New York Times rave.
I remember that, yeah.
And then some, literally, we're all downstairs, me, Hannah, Rodney, and Tom, and Andy Chris, the house manager, company manager, box office manager, everything else manager, said, this agency is upstairs. Can you guys come upstairs? And he wants to meet you. And we all ran up there being like, what is this? And it was a big agency. And right from there, I got signed by them.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked into those early meetings kind of being like, you know what? I really don't want to play terrorist roles.
Yeah, of course.
And but that was like all the roles that were there. So I never worked in film and TV, really. But really what was happening is I said, I want to do sitcoms. So I tested for a bunch of sitcoms, but nothing really happened there.
Why did you want to do sitcoms? What was interesting about that work?
Because I thought I was in the comedy world. Remember, I don't even remember what I was doing, improv at the time.
That's right.
I was doing improv. You know, I just thought comedy was an easy place for me to go. And again, I didn't want to play terrorists.
Right.
You know, and there was nothing else to do. I mean, there's really not, you know, there was no roles. And so, sitcoms seemed like a cool thing to do. I booked a couple of things here and there, but nothing really went anywhere, to be honest with you. I just kept on doing a bunch of plays. Again, everything was Middle East before, for your listeners, like, before Succession, I only played Middle Easterners.
Right.
Like, I mean, literally, period. I was in Fever Chart. I was in this play. I played an Israeli. I played a Palestinian. I played.
You were in Homebody Kabul at BAM.
I was in Homebody Kabul at BAM. I was, this play called Mass about three Palestinian brothers written by an Israeli. Like, all I did was Middle Eastern plays. And then I did Bengal Tiger. And those are the only places that they were showing them as human beings.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, the theater was the only place that's like, oh, no, this is a fully dimensional character, or they'd at least listen to me because of the years of Waterwell and creating our own shit. Like, you know, listen to me to be like, hey, yeah, maybe I'll try a little bit of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened was I got dropped by my agents.
Really?
After I was nominated for a Tony Award.
For Bengal Tiger?
Yeah.
And then they dropped you?
Yes.
Did they say why?
I didn't make enough money.
Oh, fuck me. Okay, wow.
I also had a four-month-old.
Right.
And a two-year-old.
Right.
I'd been living on, this is year four of unemployment checks. You know what I mean? It was just a rough go, dude. We were just struggling. And now all of a sudden I'm dropped. And not only was it demoralizing, it just broke me. It just crushed me. Because not only that, I also hired, everyone's like, you gotta hire a publicist. So I hired this top tier publicist, but I couldn't afford it. And so right. I owed them money still. It was just like, everything was downhill, downhill, downhill. And really what came out of that, honestly, like very, very low point, was I stopped putting my faith in agents. I started thinking about them in a different way. I thought of them as middlemen. Mm-hmm. I don't even have an agent right now.
Really?
The reason why agents get 10% is because they're doing 10% of the work. Focus on the 90. Focus right. on the 90. And that, when I got dropped after Bengal Tiger, right after being nominated, I literally was like, you know what? I'm going to focus on the 90. Mm. And the moment that happened, even though I was saying no to terrorist roles prior to that, I was now even more emboldened to be like, you know what? No to that too. And we were broke, but I was getting more and more agency and more oomph. And along the way, anyone that said no to anything that we were thinking about, with Waterwell, Accidental Wolf, any of it, I was just like, fuck it, we're doing it ourselves anyway. And that was the process for me. It was just like, I'm just going to push through. And that gave me so much confidence, you know? And along the way, it just dawned on me that I have ownership over my craft. Mm-hmm. And though I was broke, I was doing better work. Mm-hmm. I really was. I was getting deeper with it. I was empathizing with the nth degree of what this person might look like.
Mm-hmm. And then the paying work came.
Yeah.
As a result.
And the paying work came. And then I did The Humans. That was the other thing. I had a great year. I did The Guards of the Taj at the Atlantic, which won a bunch of, like, the Lortel and the Outer Crit, and won a bunch of awards. And then I did The Humans the same year.
Right.
And those won a bunch of awards. And then right in The Humans, you know, the Succession sports started coming, and you know, that's kind of how that happened, yeah.
So one thing that always fascinates me about being an actor, since I'm not an actor, right, is the metric ton of feedback about your work that you get time. Whether it's notes from a director, the vibe of the audience in the room, someone saying, I fucking hated you at the stage door while you're signing their program, reviews, tweets, whatever it is, there's just like a lot of the world's opinion of you coming at you.
Yeah,
and as you've become more prominent as an actor, I'm just wondering about how you've learned how to navigate that.
It's tricky. You know, I'm just going to talk about Doll's House because that's the most immediate thing. And every night there was a reaction, you know, and our job in doing a Doll's House was to tell the most honest truths that we can with regards to what this might actually look like if this was a real thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's basically what we were going after. And in those truths, a lot of love, hate, you know, all that's in there. But because of a Doll's House, there is no set.
Right.
There is no props. There's no nothing. And so what's happening is you, as an audience member, are putting your own DNA and filling in our house and filling in the props and filling in Nora and filling in Torvald and filling in Krogstad. You are now putting your own DNA all over that shit. But your DNA is different than my Iranian mom's DNA, who is seeing something completely different. So then you go to the stage door. And you hear someone say, I fucking hate your Torvald, makes me sick to my stomach. Like, someone's said shit like that. If not exactly like that, but like, they detest. There's people that fucking hated my Torvald.
Right.
Hated him. Wanted to punch him in the, I would get that a lot. I wanted to punch him in the face. I could slap him in the face. And then you then are like, but he also is a human being.
Right.
So now I'm going to give you the opposite. Sometimes it happens where this would happen. I think it was like 60-40, 60% like really despised him, 40% like really like thought he was just a clueless male idiot that, you know, but didn't hate him. I got into a line where there was like three or four people that really were sympathetic, women, sympathetic to Torvald.
They
were in a group, so it may be like one person's influence kind of like influenced the group, but now all four of them are Team Torvi. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Which is crazy, but also you can get it. Now I find myself being like, I know, but you know, he is controlling, he's a narcissist.
Right.
Like, I'm also now fighting them, being like, I know, but like...
But no, didn't you want him to punch me in the face? Didn't you want to punch me in the face?
Exactly. Yeah. So, and that's about me.
Mm-hmm.
That's about me. I am definitely wanting everyone to understand every aspect of my character of Torvald. And if they don't, I feel like, you know, I feel like I've failed miserably. But the reality is that, yeah, the person that doesn't understand that's sympathetic and wants to punch me in the face is giving me a compliment. It's a fucked up way of receiving a compliment. But it is, they are trying to give me a fucking compliment. So that's one portion. And the other is, you know, the pain of, you know, acting for me, I have a lot of hats. Acting for me is the hardest hat. Because I feel like I'm unveiling a portion of myself to the audience.
Yeah.
And trying to do it realistically and, you know, even with characters that are so opposite of who I am. And that's, you can judge that. And that's a scary thing to always hear. You know, I feel for all actors because it's you're in anything that you play, whether you're playing Richard III or whatever, like you are revealing a portion of who you are in these words. And that is a scary thing to do. That's why people are definitely afraid to go and talking in front of public.
Right.
You know, they don't want to reveal that shit. They don't want to fucking be like, oh, I'm, you know, and we do it on the regular. But,
right.
But with Doll's House, to be real with you, I've learned so much of how human beings behave, how Torvald behaves, that to me, it's so easy for me to put that shit aside and be like, that's over. I really, you know, my wife probably would say, who's really like, I bet you she would say my hardest moments are during the rehearsal process. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I bet you she would say that that's when the stuff comes home a little bit more. But when I'm done with the character, when the show is done, it's done. Let's go hang out.
Awesome. Well, Aryan, thank you so much for joining us to talk about your process.
Thanks, buddy. Thank you for having me.
Good
and
talking.
It's so great to see you. Congrats on everything, man.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Up next, Isaac and I will talk about the benefits and downsides of high-intensity creative work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at Progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Isaac, that was amazing. What an interesting, thoughtful guy. I was really struck by Aryan's story of not getting into acting schools, but then being happy that he did get into Indiana because they gave him the opportunity to do a ton of shows. And I sense from your response that 15 shows in 4 years really is a lot. That kind of learning by doing and doing really quickly really suits some people, and it drives others away, which is maybe a good thing because they learn early on the reality of a profession or a vocation. Maybe it isn't what they thought. But Aryan really learned a lot by just trying stuff, riffing, repeating. What's your response to that do it as much as you can approach to work and art?
Well, first of all, let me say, yeah, I think 15 shows in 4 years is a lot. I basically neglected all of my schoolwork to do as much theater as possible in college. And I think I did like 12 or 13 shows. You know, there was one semester where I did three shows and it nearly killed me. But that wasn't really what you were asking about. Enough about me. You know, I do love the do as much as possible approach in your early career anyway. You know, when you're thinking like, whenever it comes to you that you might want to do something as your real career or passion for your life, your vocation or whatever. And that could be when you're in high school. That could be when you're in your 50s. You know, I don't actually think the age part of it matters. It's at the beginning. I just think you want to do as much in that field as possible.
Yeah.
Get the reps in, try a bunch of different roles, try a bunch of different styles, make yourself useful, meet a lot of people and work. Mm. If I could go back and tell young me one thing, it would probably be like, you actually don't know anything. So just keep working as much and as often as possible.
Yeah. And what you said about meeting as many people as possible, that really makes a ton of sense too.
Yeah. You know, we tend to cast aspersions on the social aspects of the creative businesses. You know, it's not what you know, it's who you know or whatever. But I don't know a single profession in which knowing people in your field is a negative thing isn't going to help you both creatively and in your career. You need to know a lot of people. It is part of being a doctor. You know, it's part of being a journalist. It started being a plumber. It's like, you want to know people in your field. Some of that's careerist. Some of that's so you have friends who know the same struggles that you do. And some of that's just, you're going to learn a lot, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, just to interject here that while the topic of this episode is not the actors' strike, it does seem worth mentioning that there are many reasons why actors want to act and writers want to write, and getting paid is a significant one, but it's not the only one. By choosing to withdraw their labor because they're fighting for a fair contract, actors are also depriving themselves of those reps, the opportunity to explore their talent and do the work that they love.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. My last book, The Method, How the 20th Century Learned to Act, the last third of that book is mostly about the Actors Studio. And the story behind the founding of the Actors Studio is that Cheryl Crawford, Elia Kazan, and Bobby Lewis started it so that actors would have a kind of gymnasium for acting, for their craft that they could, you know, work out in between plays, because all they were doing in between plays is hanging out at a diner and waiting by the payphone for their agent to call with an audition, literally. And so, you know, that tells you something about, in order to practice the craft of acting, you have to have a bunch of people in a room together, you know? Yeah. And so if you're voluntarily like, nope, actually, we're not doing that, and we're all agreeing we're not going to do that, it really can hurt your craft on some level. And also, like people in all sorts of other professions, actors and writers gain some amount of dignity and self-definition from the work we do, right? And deliberately depriving yourself of that thing that really shapes your life is emotionally a complicated thing. At least from talking to my friends who are on strike right now, that's what it seems like.
Wow, okay. Just listening to Arian, I understood why he is a start-your-own-company kind of guy. He has opinions, and he clearly lives his politics, even if that costs him roles and money. He will not play terrorist roles, even though, as an Iranian immigrant, those are parts that casting agents would surely be very happy to put him in. So rather than waiting to be cast, he and some like-minded collaborators created a company to do their own mission-driven thing. And of course, my mind goes right to that old, my dad's got a barn, let's put on a show cliche. But in the real world, doing your own thing is really hard. It's not an option that appeals to or suits everyone. And, you know, the level of difficulty varies depending on what your particular art form is. Isaac, are you a do-it-yourselfer? And additionally, what kinds of things should people think about before they try to form, you know, their own acting company or blog or record label or whatever their art requires?
I'm like half a DIY guy. I love the spirit of building your own thing. And I have gone to build my own thing several times, and I have completely failed in the execution of it, with one exception, which is the blog I had, which slowly transformed me into a writer.
Oh.
The way that I maintain that spirit is, if there's a problem that needs to be solved, I'm probably just going to go and solve it myself.
Yeah.
I am probably not going to reach out to someone else. I am probably, you know, it's in the theater thing where it's like, you see a floor that needs to be swept. It's like, well, go fucking sweep it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think it's also because of certain issues that I have to work on, which is that I don't like relying on other people. Mm-hmm. And I find asking for help incredibly challenging.
Yeah.
So the thing that I have actually had to work on over the past decade is not doing everything myself and actually asking people to do things that need to be done so that I'm not doing everything all the time.
Interesting. I was really struck by Arian's story of finding his character in Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo via punctuation, you know, the exclamation points at the end of the line.
Yeah.
I'm an artist, even though the writer later told him it was actually a period in the text. Now, what I'm about to say will probably sound like a weird response to that, but bear with me. I enjoy accents, and I have found that the best way to kind of get an accent is to grab onto a very specific phrase or a sound from the accent to get into it. So like for a white South African accent, it would be a pin, as in, do you have a pin? A pin to chat with? Or for a Kiwi, it would be like the weird way they pronounce the letter I, like fush and chirps, or have you funished? So in a weird way, I feel like I'm describing a version of the method, you know, using a phrase or a piece of punctuation to attach to something so you can summon it at will. Am I making any sense, Mr. Method?
Yeah, I mean, that totally makes sense. Look, before an actor realizes a character, all that character is blobs of ink on a piece of paper, right? They don't actually exist. They're not real. But the text gives you a ton of clues about who they are. And in fact, one of the things you can do while the inspiration isn't flowing is to go back to the text and, you know, mine it for more and more clues about who the person is and the context of their life. Now, some actors, because we brought up punctuation, are very hostile to punctuation. You know, Christopher Walken always erases all the punctuation in his text, but most people pay attention to it, you know? What this actually reminds me of is a long time ago, it was maybe even the first year of working, I did an interview with the wonderful choreographer, Annie B. Parson, and she said she never gets creatively blocked because she focuses on small things. She's always focusing on and looking for small things. And I feel like what this all brings up is that there actually is always a little thing that you could be focusing on.
Ah, there's always something to go to.
Yeah.
One last thing that this admittedly is something I was just thinking of Arian's acting. I haven't seen him on stage, but my impression of him in Succession and also the late underrated Madam Secretary, which was positively Law and Order-ish in its employment of excellent New York-based actors, was supported by something he said. So he's the kind of actor who makes audience members feel things, you know, to understand the emotions of what's happening on the screen. So in Succession, I was always a bit confused about who exactly Stewie was, whose friend was he, whose interest was he representing, what am I supposed to think about him? I never really knew, but it didn't matter because I always felt what he was conveying, like, oh, he's freaking out Kendall, or he's reassuring Shiv, or he's confusing Roman. I knew what the vibe was. And being right. able to set a vibe in whatever medium you're working, that's an amazing talent.
Yeah, totally. I mean, Stewie is a very enigmatic character on purpose, right? Kendall should never be sure if he can trust him.
Yes.
And since Kendall is our primary point of view character, neither should we. But also, you know, if you watch the show, go back to it, you know, Stewie is usually the voice of reason. And even if he's a bit, you know, perverse and mischievous. And
yes.
Kendall is a total lunatic. Like if you did the show from Stewie's point of view, you'd probably see that, yes, he's out for himself and he has a very complicated relationship with this old friend of his. But that old friend of his is also constantly hatching grandiose schemes for no reason, right? Anyway,
right.
This is not a Succession podcast, but it brings me to an old acting adage is don't worry about what your character is feeling. Worry about what your character wants the scene partner's character to feel, right?
Mm.
Don't worry about what you're doing. Worry about getting the other person to do something. You just constantly want to ask those kinds of questions that get you out of yourself and into the world of the scene. And I think that's true of most creative endeavors, actually, right? Like you don't want to be thinking, is this paragraph I'm writing, are people going to think that it's well written or, you know, whatever. But it's like, what effect do I actually want this paragraph to have? I think Aryan is exceptionally good at that. And and some of it just comes from who he is as a person. He's not an egotistical actor. He's not in it to be a star. He's not in it because he needs love. You know what I mean? He's in it to connect to something true in the world.
Yeah. Well, Aryan, we love your work, and listeners, we love you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have, remember to subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts. That way, you will never miss an episode. And just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Slow Burn and Big Mood, Little Mood, and you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more, go to slate.com/workingplus.
Thank you to Aryan Moyed and to our amazing producers, Cameron Drews and Kevin Bendis. We'll be back next week with June's conversation with the amazing playwright Madeline George, who wrote the script for Audible.com's audio version of Alison Bechdel's Dykes to Watch Out For. Until then, get back to work.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.